so obliging of you. No, we should not have heard, if it had not been for this particular circumstance of her being to come here so soon. We are talking of Jane's visit, Mother. She is so delighted, for Jane is to be 3 months with us at least. She says so positively, as I am going to have the pleasure of reading to you. The case is, you see, that the new Mrs. Dixon has convinced the Campbells to visit her in Ireland directly. She is so impatient to see her dear parents again, for till she married last October, she was never away from them so much as a week, which must make it very strange to be in different countries. They are to meet in Dublin, so says Jane, and the Dixons shall take them back to their country seat, Ballycraig, a beautiful place, I fancy. Jane has heard of a great deal of its beauty. From Mr. Dixon, I mean, as Jane used to be very often walking out with them. Of course, she heard everything he might be telling Miss Campbell about his own home in Ireland. Jane was quite longing to go to Ireland for Mr. Dixon's account of things.
Well, then how fortunate that Miss Fairfax should be allowed to come to you rather than visiting Mrs. Dixon.
Very true indeed. But you see, everything turns out for the best. Mr. and Mrs. Dixon do quite depend upon Jane joining them in Ireland, as you will hear presently. Mr. Dixon does not seem in the least backward in any attention. He is the most charming young man. Ever since the service he rendered Jane at Weymouth, when they were out in that party on the water, did I tell you of it before? She, by the sudden whirling round of something or other among the sails, would have been dashed into the sea at once, and actually was all but gone if Mr. Dixon had not, with the greatest presence of mind, caught hold of her habit. I can never think of it without trembling. Ever since we had the history of that day, I have been so fond of Mr. Dixon.
But in spite of all her friend's urgency and her own wish of seeing Ireland, Miss Fairfax prefers devoting the time to you and Mrs. Bates?
Yes, entirely her own doing. And Colonel and Mrs. Campbell think she does quite right and particularly wish her to try her native air, as she has not been quite so well as usual lately.
I am concerned to hear of it.
Jane caught a bad cold. Poor thing. So long ago as the 7th of November, and has never been well since. A long time, is it not, for a cold to hang upon her? The Campbells and I are quite in agreement that 3 or 4 months at Highbury will entirely cure her, and it is certainly a great deal better than she should come here than go to Ireland, if she is unwell. Nobody could nurse her as we should do.
It appears to me the most desirable arrangement in the world.
And so she's to come to us next Friday or Saturday. If Jane does not get well soon, we will call in Mr. Perry. Well, now, I have just given you a hint of what Jane writes about. We will turn to her letter, and I am sure she tells her own story a great deal better than I can tell it for her.
I am afraid we must be running away, Miss Bates. My father will be expecting us. I had no intention. I thought I had no power of staying more than 5 minutes when I first entered the house. I merely called because I would not pass the door without inquiring after Mrs. Bates. But I have been so pleasantly detained. And now, however, we must wish you and Mrs. Bates good morning.
And nothing that could be urged to detain her succeeded. She regained the street, happy that although she had in fact heard the whole substance of Jane Fairfax's letter, she had been able to escape the letter itself. Jane Fairfax's history was one which raised her in the opinion of most. She was an orphan, the only child of Miss Jane Bates and Lieutenant Fairfax. The gallant officer died in action abroad, and his widow soon sank under consumption and grief, leaving Jane, her young daughter, in the charge of her grandmother and aunt, Mrs. and Miss Bates. From that time on, there had seemed every probability of her being permanently fixed in Highbury with very limited means and no advantages of connection or improvement. But the compassionate feelings of a friend of her father gave a change to her destiny. This was Colonel Campbell, who was saved from a fatal camp fever by the attentions of Lieutenant Fairfax. These were claims which the Colonel did not overlook, and upon his return to England a few years following the death of poor Fairfax, he sought out the child and took notice of her. He was a married man with only one living child, a girl about Jane's age. Jane became their guest, paying them long visits and growing a favourite with all. In time, Jane came to belong to Colonel Campbell's family and lived with them entirely, only visiting her grandmother, the good Mrs. Bates, from time to time. Her heart and understanding had received every influence of discipline and culture, and Colonel Campbell's residence being in London, every lighter talent had been done full justice to by the attendance of first-rate masters. The plan was that she should be brought up for educating others, since it would provide her with a respectable subsistence when she left the family. Such was Jane Fairfax's history. The marriage of Miss Campbell had very lately taken place, leaving her eligibly and happily settled, while Jane Fairfax had yet her bread to earn. She had now reached the age which her own judgment had fixed on for beginning her path of duty. The Campbells, however, in all their steady affection for Jane, were glad to catch at any reasonable excuse for not hurrying on the wretched moment of her departure. She had never been quite well since the time of their daughter's marriage. Until she should have completely recovered her usual strength, they must forbid her engaging in duties. With regard to her not accompanying them to Ireland, her account to her aunt contained nothing but truth, though there might be some truths not told. Emma was sorry to have to pay civilities to a person she did not like through 3 long months. Why she did not like Jane Fairfax might be a difficult question to answer. Mr. Knightley had once told her it was because she saw in her the really accomplished young woman which she wanted to be thought herself. And though the accusation had been eagerly refuted at the time, there were moments of self-examination in which her conscience could not quite acquit her. It was a dislike so little just, every imputed fault was so magnified by fancy, that she never saw Jane Fairfax the first time after any considerable absence without feeling she had injured her. Now, when the due visit was paid on her arrival after a 2 years' interval, she was particularly struck with the very appearance and manners which for those 2 whole years she had been depreciating. Jane Fairfax was remarkably elegant, and there was a very pleasing beauty in her face and features. Upon the whole, Emma left her with such softened, charitable feelings as made her look around in walking home and lament that Highbury afforded nobody worthy of giving her independence. Not one young man that she could wish to scheme about for her. Complimented herself on her fresh appreciation of Jane Fairfax and soon invited her to Hartfield. Her feelings were charming, to be sure, but they were not lasting. One evening of Miss Fairfax, together with her aunt and grandmother, was enough for all the former provocations to reappear. Emma recounted them to Mr. Knightley the following morning.
She is so affected. Did you observe her air of greatness in applauding my playing? It was only to show off her own superior performance. And she is so cold, so cautious. There is no getting at her real opinion. She is wrapped up in a cloak of politeness. She was disgustingly, suspiciously reserved. As for her opinion on Mr. Dixon...
What of it?
She had none. She seemed bent on giving no real insight into his character or any opinion of the match with Miss Campbell, her dearest friend. She is concealing something, I am sure of it.
She was reserved, but very equal in her reports of everyone.
Precisely. Not a syllable of real information.
Perhaps you made too many inquiries.
It was conversation, Mr. Knightley. Conversation does not very well get along without inquiries. No, there was an artifice in all her answers. It was just the same when we spoke of Frank Churchill. They had been at Weymouth at the same time. It was known that they were a little acquainted, but I could procure nothing as to what he truly was. Was he handsome, agreeable, well-mannered? She deferred only to the general opinion of him. Everybody can recite the general opinion of him. But Jane has been in his company and refuses to say anything of his character or his person. I cannot forgive her.
There was a moment, Emma, just a few days ago, if you remember, when you were quite just in realizing Jane's merits and giving them credit. I took great pleasure in marking that improvement. I hope you have not forgotten it entirely.
And do not
but here comes your father, who I feel sure would like to hear how much we enjoyed the evening. Mr. Woodhouse!
Good morning, Mr. Knightley. I do hope you had a pleasant evening last night.
Very pleasant evening, sir. I thank you. We were just talking of it. I'm sure Miss Fairfax must have found the evening pleasant, Emma, for you left nothing undone. I was glad you made her play so much, since she has no instrument at her grandmother's. It must have been a real indulgence.
I'm happy you approved, but I hope I am not often deficient in what is due to guests at Hartfield.
No, my dear, that I am sure you are not. There is nobody half so attentive and civil as you are. If anything, you are too attentive. The muffin last night, if it had been handed round once, I think it would have been enough.
Emma is not often deficient either in manner or understanding.
I understand that Miss Fairfax is reserved in every matter imaginable.
I always told you she was, a little. But you will soon overcome all that part of her reserve which ought to be overcome, all that has its foundation in diffidence. What arises from discretion must be honoured.
You think her diffident? I do not see it.
My dear Emma, you are not going to tell me, I hope, that you had not a pleasant evening.
Oh, no. I was pleased with my own perseverance in asking questions, and amused to think how little information I obtained.
I am disappointed.
I do hope everybody had a pleasant evening. I had. Once I felt the fire rather too much, but then I moved back my chair a little, a very little, and it did not disturb me. Miss Bates was very chatty and good-humoured, as she always is, and Mrs. Bates is agreeable, too, in a different way. I like old friends, and Miss Jane Fairfax is a very well-behaved young lady indeed. She must have found the evening agreeable, Mr. Knightley, because she had Emma.
True, sir, and Emma, I hope, because she had Miss Fairfax.
In truth, she is a sort of elegant creature that one cannot keep one's eyes from. I am always watching her to admire, and I do pity her from my heart.
I am most glad to hear it. But I almost forgot. I have a piece of news for you. You like news, and I heard an article on my way hither that I think will interest you.
News? Oh, yes, I always like news. What is it? Why do you smile so? Where did you hear it? At Randall's?
No, not at Randall's. I have not been near Randall's.
It was at this crucial moment in the relay that Miss Bates and Miss Fairfax were announced. Miss Bates naturally led the way and was in such a flutter of spirits that it exceeded even her customary degree of excitement.
Oh, my dear Mr. Woodhouse, how are you this morning, Miss Woodhouse? Mr. Knightley, how do you do? I come quite overpowered. Have you heard the news? Mr. Elton is going to be married.
Oh.
There is my news. I thought it would interest you.
But where could you hear it? Where could you possibly hear it, Mr. Knightley? For it is not 5 minutes since I received Mrs. Cole's note. No, it cannot be more than 5, or at least 10, for I have got my bonnet and Spencer on, and just then came the note. And Miss Hawkins, that's all I know, and Miss Hawkins of Bath. But, Mr. Knightley, how could you possibly have heard it? For the very moment Mr. Cole told Mrs. Cole of it, she sat down and wrote to me. And Miss Hawkins...
I was with Mr. Cole on business an hour and a half ago. He'd just read Elton's letter as I was shown in and handed it to me directly.
Well, that is quite... I suppose there never was a piece of news more generally interesting. What, Mr. Knightley, and so you actually saw the letter?
It was short, merely to announce, but cheerful, exulting, of course. The information was, as you state, that he was going to be married to a Miss Hawkins. By his style, I should imagine it just settled.
A Mr. Elton going to be married? Everybody will wish his happiness, I am sure.
He is very young to settle. He had better not be in a hurry. He seemed to me very well off as he was. We were always glad to see him at Hartfield.
A new neighbour for us all, Miss Woodhouse. This is great news indeed. Jane, you have never seen Mr. Elton. No wonder that you have such a curiosity to see him.
No, I have never seen Mr. Elton. Is he a tall man?
My father would say yes, Mr. Knightley no, and Miss Bates and I that he is just the happy medium. When you have been here a little longer, Miss Fairfax, you will understand that Mr. Elton is the standard of perfection in Highbury, both in person and mind.
Very true, Miss Woodhouse, so she will. He is the very best young man. But, my dear Jane, if you remember, I told you yesterday he was precisely the height of Mr. Perry. I think there are few places with such society as Highbury. I always say we are quite blessed in our neighbours.
As to who or what Miss Hawkins is, or how long Mr. Elton has been acquainted with her, nothing, I suppose, can be known. One feels that it cannot be a very long acquaintance. He has been gone only 4 weeks.
No, indeed. I know nothing of it. Do you, Mr. Knightley? Did Mr. Cole say anything to you on the matter?
I am no wiser than you, madam.
You are silent, Miss Fairfax, but I hope you mean to take an interest in this news. You who have been hearing and seeing so much of late on these subjects on Miss Campbell's account. We shall not excuse your being indifferent about Mr. Elton and Miss Hawkins.
When I have seen Mr. Elton, I dare say I shall be interested, but I believe it requires that with me. And as it is but a few months since Miss Campbell married, the impression may be a little worn off.
Oh, what a swift business! He has been gone just 4 weeks, as you observe, Miss Woodhouse. 4 weeks yesterday. And Miss Hawkins? Well, I had always rather fancied it would be some young lady hereabouts. Not that I ever... Mrs. Cole once whispered to me, but I immediately said, no, Mr. Elton is a most worthy young man, but in short, I do not think I am particularly quick at those sort of discoveries. I do not pretend to it. What is before me, I see. At the same time, nobody could wonder if Mr. Elton should have aspired, but Miss Woodhouse lets me chatter on so good-humouredly. She knows I would not offend for the world. Have you heard from Mrs. John Knightley lately? Oh, those dear little children. Jane, do you know, I always fancy Mr. Dixon like Mr. John Knightley. I mean in person, tall and with that sort of look, and not very talkative.
Quite wrong, my dear aunt. There is no likeness at all.
Very odd, but one never does form a just idea of anybody beforehand. One takes up a notion and runs away with it. Mr. Dixon, you say, is not, strictly speaking, handsome?
Handsome? Oh, no, far from it. Certainly plain. I told you he was plain.
Oh, my dear, you said that Miss Campbell would not allow him to be plain, and that you yourself...
Oh, as for me, my judgment is worth nothing. Where I have a regard, I always think a person well-looking. But I gave what I believed the general opinion when I called him plain.
Well, my dear Jane, I believe we must be running away. The weather does not look well, and Grandmama will be uneasy. You are too obliging, my dear Miss Woodhouse, but we really must take leave. This has been a most agreeable piece of news indeed. Good morning to you all.
May I accompany you, ladies? I'm returning to Donwell myself.
Oh, well, that is so very kind. I am sure if Jane is tired, you would be so kind as to give her your arm. Mr. Elton and Miss Hawkins, what a piece of news. Good morning, Mr. Woodhouse. Miss Woodhouse.
To Emma, it was an amusing and a very welcome piece of news, as proving that Mr. Elton could not have suffered long. But she was sorry for Harriet, who must feel it. All that she could hope was that by giving the first information herself, she would save her from hearing it abruptly from others. It was now about the time that Harriet was likely to call. Since she was expected any moment, Mr. Woodhouse left Emma to converse with her friend in private. It began to rain heavily, and Emma expected that it would detain Harriet at Mrs. Goddard's. The shower was short, however, and it had not been over 5 minutes when in came Harriet with just the heated, agitated look which hurrying thither with a full heart was likely to give.
Oh, Miss Woodhouse, what do you think has happened?
Harriet, I hope you are not too perturbed. Come, stand by the fire. Your shoes are damp.
I had set out from Mrs. Goddard's 30 minutes ago. I had been afraid it would rain, but I thought I might get to Hartfield first. I had hurried on as fast as possible, but then, as I was passing by the house where a young woman was making up a gown for me, I thought I would just step in and see how it went on. I did not stay half a moment there. But soon after I came out, it began to rain, and I did not know what to do. So I ran on directly as fast as I could and took shelter at Ford's, as good a shop as any, and one where I might look at ribbons while I waited, you know? And so there I had sat a full 10 minutes, perhaps, when all of a sudden, who should come in? To be sure, it was so very odd, but they always dealt at Ford's. Who should come in but Elizabeth Martin and her brother? Dear Miss Woodhouse, only think. I thought I should have fainted. I did not know what to do. I was sitting near the door. Elizabeth saw me directly, but Mr. Martin did not. He was busy with the umbrella. I am certain she saw me, but I looked away directly and took no notice. And they both went to quite the farther end of the shop, and I kept sitting near the door. Oh, dear, I was so miserable. I am sure I must have been as white as my gown. I could not go away, you know, because of the rain, but I did so wish myself anywhere in the world but there. Well, at last he looked round and saw me, and they began whispering to one another. Presently Miss Martin came forward, came quite up to me, and asked me how I did. She did not speak with me in the same way that she used. I could see she was altered, but, however, I did try to be very friendly, and we shook hands and stood talking a good while. By that time, the rain was beginning to hold up, and I was determined that nothing should stop me from getting away. At that moment, I found Mr. Martin was coming up towards me too. Slowly, you know, and as if he did not quite know what to do. And so he came and spoke, and I answered, and I stood for a minute, feeling dreadfully, you know, one can't tell how. Then I took courage and said it did not rain and I must go, and so off I set. And I had not got 3 yards from the door when he came after me, only to say if I was going to Hartfield, he thought I had much better go round by Mr. Cole's stables, for I should find the near way quite floated by this rain. I thought it would have been the death of me. So I said I was very much obliged to him. You know I could not do less. And then he went back to Elizabeth, and I came round by the stables. Oh, Miss Woodhouse, I would rather have done anything than have it happen. And yet, you know, there was a sort of satisfaction in seeing him behave so pleasantly and so kindly. And Elizabeth, too. Oh, Miss Woodhouse, do talk to me and make me feel comfortable again.
Very sincerely did Emma wish to do so, but it was not immediately in her power. She was obliged to stop and think. The young man's conduct and his sister's seemed the result of real feeling, and she could not but pity them. As Harriet described it, there had been an interesting mixture of wounded affection and genuine delicacy in their behaviour. But what difference did this make in the evils of the connection? It was folly to be disturbed by it. Of course he must be sorry to lose her. They must all be sorry. Ambition as well as love had probably been mortified. Emma exerted herself and did try to make her friend comfortable by considering all that had passed as a mere trifle and quite unworthy of being dwelt on.
My dear Harriet, it might be distressing for the moment, but you behaved extremely well. And it is over, and may never, can never, as a first meeting, occur again. Therefore, you need not think about it.
Oh, yes, very true. You are quite right, I shall not think about it.
But still, Harriet talked of it, still. She could talk of nothing else, and Emma, in order to put the Martins out of her head, was obliged to hurry on the news which she had meant to give with so much tender caution. Yet Harriet accepted the news without much alarm. Emma hardly knew whether to rejoice, or be angry, ashamed, or only amused. Mr. Elton's rights, however, gradually revived, as Harriet imagined everything about this fortunate Miss Hawkins. The result of such speculation was to place the Martins under proper subordination in her fancy. In this, at least, Emma could take some satisfaction. The following days brought no escape in Harriet's mind or in the whole of Highbury from the topic of Mr. Elton and the charming Augusta Hawkins, whose perfect beauty and merit was complemented with an independent fortune. When Mr. Elton arrived in Highbury for only a short stay, he had given Mrs. Cole a history of the rise and progress of the glorious affair, the steps so quick, from the first encounter to the dinner at Mr. Green's and the party at Mrs. Brown's, smiles and blushes rising in importance. The lady had been so easily impressed, so sweetly disposed, had in short, to use a most intelligible phrase, been so very ready to have him that vanity and prudence were equally contented. When Mr. Elton set out for Bath again, there was a general expectation that when he next entered Highbury, he would bring his bride. During his present short stay, Emma had only seen him once, and he had not improved by the mixture of pique and pretension now spread over his air. She was, in fact, beginning very much to wonder that she had ever thought him pleasing at all. Of Miss Hawkins, Emma thought very little. Setting aside her £10,000, it did not appear that she was at all Harriet's superior. She brought no name, no blood, no alliance. Miss Hawkins was the daughter of a Bristol merchant, of course, he must be called. And all the grandeur of the connection seemed dependent on her elder sister, who was very well married to a gentleman in a great way near Bristol who kept two carriages. That was the wind-up of the history. That was the glory of Miss Hawkins. Harriet, meanwhile, was sunk in unhappiness at the engagement, though it had been a little put aside by Elizabeth Martin's calling for her, and since Harriet had not been home, leaving a note of real delicacy and kindness. While Mr. Elton stayed, the Martins were forgotten, but on the very morning of his setting off for Bath again, Emma, to dissipate some of the distress it occasioned, judged it best for her to return Elizabeth Martin's visit. It was a delicate matter, however. It must be done in a way that suggested only a formal acquaintance. Emma meant to take her in the carriage, leave her at Abbey Mill while she drove a little farther, and call for her again so soon as to allow no time for insidious applications or dangerous recurrences to the past. She could think of nothing better, and though there was something in it which her own heart could not approve, something of ingratitude merely glossed over, it must be done, or what would become of Harriet? Emma resolved on the plan and took the carriage the following morning to Mrs. Goddard's, where Harriet awaited her. But there was something wanting in her spirits.
It's so kind of you to bring the carriage.
You look a little pale, Harriet. Are you unwell?
I have just seen a trunk.
A trunk?
Directed to the Reverend Philip Elton, White Hart, Bath. It was lifted onto a cart directly before me on its way to meet the next coach.
Oh, dear. I am sorry for it. But come now, we must think of brighter things. We shall shortly be at the farm.
Oh, and I am so looking forward to seeing the Martins again. Think you Mr. Martin will be there?
I am expecting Elizabeth, but I could not say. I only hope it is a pleasant visit, though it must be brief.
When they parted, Emma observed her to be looking around with a sort of fearful curiosity, which determined her not to allow the visit to exceed the proposed quarter of an hour. She went on herself to give that portion of time to an old servant who was married and settled in Donwell. The quarter of an hour brought her punctually to the White Gate again, and Miss Smith, receiving her summons, was with her without delay, and unattended by any alarming young man. She hurried into the carriage, her face wet with tears.
My dear Harriet, was it a very painful meeting?
Mrs. Martin and the Miss Martins, they were so very kind to me. And not even time for tea. And I have grown.
My dear Harriet, why should your height be lamented?
On the wainscot by the window, there were penciled marks for our height, mine and the Miss Martins. He had made those marks and written our names by them last September. We each of us remembered the day, the hour, the happy occasion. We all seem to feel the same regrets and be ready to return to the same good understanding. We were just becoming ourselves again when the carriage reappeared, and all was over.
The style of the visit and the shortness of it were then felt to be decisive. 14 minutes to be given to those with whom she had thankfully passed 6 weeks, not 6 months ago. Emma could not but picture it all and feel how justly they might resent, how naturally Harriet must suffer. It was a bad business. She would have given a great deal to have had the Martins in even a little higher rank of life. But as it was, how could she have done otherwise? Impossible. They must be separated. But there was a great deal of pain in the process, so much to herself at this time that she soon felt the necessity of a little consolation, and resolved on going home by way of Randall's to procure it. Her mind was quite sick of Mr. Elton and the Martins. The refreshment of Randall's was absolutely necessary. It was a good scheme, but on driving to the door they heard that neither master nor mistress was at home. The man believed they were gone to Hartfield. So, to Hartfield, they must also return.
This is too bad. And now we shall just miss them. Too provoking. I do not know when I have been so disappointed. Why have we stopped?
Look, it is Mr. and Mrs. Weston.
Oh, good morning.
How do you do? How do you do? We have been sitting with your father. Glad to see him so well. Frank comes tomorrow. I had a letter this morning. He comes for a whole fortnight. I knew it would be so. If he had come at Christmas, he could not have stayed 3 days. I was always glad he did not come at Christmas. Now we are going to have just the right weather for him. Fine, dry, settled weather. We shall enjoy him completely. Everything has turned out exactly as we could wish.
What happy news!
We see him tomorrow by dinner time to a certainty.
He is in Oxford today. Engagements at Enscombe have most fortuitously settled to allow an entire fortnight at his command.
I am so glad. What a delightful visit it will be for you.
I shall soon bring him over to Hartfield. And you shall visit us often, I hope. Perhaps supper one day, you know, tea another. Or we have a fortnight.
We had better move on, Mr. Weston. We are detaining the girls.
Well, I am ready. But you must not be expecting such a very fine young man, Miss Woodhouse. You have only had my account, you know. I dare say he is really nothing extraordinary.
I have no doubt he is a fine young man, Mr. Weston, since being your son must be the only recommendation needed for such a claim.
Ah, you are too kind, Miss Woodhouse. Well, we must set off.
Think of me tomorrow, my dear Emma, about 4 o'clock.
4 o'clock? Depend upon it, he will be here by 3. Good day to you, Miss Woodhouse. Miss Smith.
Good day.
Good day.
Good day.
Emma's spirits were mounted quite up to happiness. Everything wore a different air. James and his horses seemed not half so sluggish as before. When she looked at the hedges, she thought the elder at least must soon be coming out. And when she turned round to Harriet, she saw something like a look of spring, a tender smile. Emma was now in a humour to see the good and the hopeful in all. The wretched business of late would soon be behind them, and tomorrow, only tomorrow, Mr. Frank Churchill would arrive in Highbury at last. The morning of the interesting day arrived, and Mrs. Weston's faithful pupil did not forget, either at 10 or 11 or 12 o'clock, that she was to think of her at 4. The clock struck 12 as she passed through the hall. "'Tis 12," she said to herself. "By this time tomorrow, perhaps, I may be thinking of the possibility of their all calling here." She opened the parlour door and saw 2 gentlemen with her father. Mr. Weston and his son.
Ah, here is Emma.
Good day, Miss Woodhouse.
Mr. Weston, this is a pleasant surprise.
Frank has arrived a day early, as you see. I told you all that he would be here before the time named. Miss Woodhouse, Mr. Frank Churchill.
It is a great pleasure to meet you, Miss Woodhouse, and so very long overdue.
Even in this moment of first meeting him, Emma did not think too much had been said in his praise. He was a very good-looking young man. Height, air, address, all were unexceptionable, and his countenance had a great deal of the spirit and liveliness of his father's. He looked quick and sensible. She felt immediately that she should like him, and there was a well-bred ease of manner and a readiness to talk which convinced her that he came intending to be acquainted with her and that acquainted they soon must be. Mr. Weston was all exultation at his arrival.
I remember what I used to do myself. One cannot creep upon a journey. One cannot help getting on faster than one has planned. And the pleasure of coming in upon one's friends before the lookout begins is worth a great deal more than any little exertion it needs.
It is a great pleasure where one can indulge in it. There are not many houses that I should presume on so far, but in coming home, I felt I might do anything.
Quite right. That is just what I say. There is nothing to compare with the comfort of home and the felicity of family and friends about you. Do I not say so, Emma?
Yes, indeed, Papa, frequently. What make you of Highbury so far, Mr. Churchill?
I am very much pleased with Randall's. I think it a most admirably arranged house. I admire its situation and the walk to Highbury. Highbury itself, though Hartfield, still more. I have always felt the interest in this country which none but one's own country gives, and the greatest curiosity to visit it.
That he should never have been able to indulge so amiable a feeling before passed suspiciously through Emma's brain. But still, if it were a falsehood, it was a pleasant one. Their subjects in general were such as belonged to an opening acquaintance. On his side were the inquiries, was she a horsewoman? Pleasant rides? Pleasant walks? Had they a large neighbourhood? Highbury perhaps afforded society enough? But when satisfied on all these points, he spoke of his mother-in-law with handsome praise and so much gratitude for the happiness she secured to his father and her very kind reception of himself. It was certain proof of his knowing how to please and of his thinking it worthwhile to try to please her. She must see more of him to understand his ways. At present, she only felt they were agreeable. She had no doubt of what Mr. Weston was often thinking about. His quick eye she detected again and again glancing towards them with a happy expression. Her own father's entire deficiency of any suspicion, however, was a most comfortable circumstance. He was not farther from approving matrimony than from foreseeing it. She blessed the favouring blindness. With all civilities exchanged and a reasonable visit paid, Mr. Weston began to move.
Well, I must be going. I have business at the Crown about my hay, and a great many errands for Mrs. Weston at Ford's. But I need not hurry anybody else.
As you are going farther on business, sir, I will take the opportunity of paying a visit, which must be paid some day or other, and therefore may as well be paid now. I have the honour of being acquainted with a neighbour of yours, a lady residing in or near Highbury, a family of the name of Fairfax. I shall have no difficulty, I suppose, in finding the house, though Fairfax, I believe, is not the proper name. I should rather say Barnes or Bates. Do you know any family of that name?
To be sure we do. Mrs. Bates, we passed her house. I saw Miss Bates at the window. True, true, you are acquainted with Miss Fairfax. I remember you knew her at Weymouth. And a fine girl she is. Call upon her by all means.
There is no necessity for my calling this morning. Another day would do as well. But there was that degree of acquaintance at Weymouth, which...
Go today. Do not defer it. What is right to be done cannot be done too soon. And besides, I must give you a hint, Frank. Any want of attention to Miss Fairfax should be carefully avoided. You saw her with the Campbells when she was the equal of everybody she mixed with. But here she is with a poor old grandmother who has barely enough to live on. If you do not call early, it will be a slight.
Miss Fairfax is a very elegant young woman.
Yes, I suppose she may be thought so.
If you were never particularly struck by her manners before, I think you will today. You will see her to advantage. See her and hear her. No, I'm afraid you will not hear her at all, for she has an aunt who never holds her tongue.
They will be extremely glad to see you, I'm sure. And one of my servants shall go with you to show you the way.
My dear sir, upon no account in the world. My father can direct me.
But your father is not going so far. He is only going to the Crown, quite on the other side of the street. And there are a great many houses. You might be very much at a loss, and it is a very dirty walk, unless you keep on the footpath. But my coachman can tell you where you had best cross the street.
No, sir, I thank you. I must refuse your kind offer.
My good friend, it is quite unnecessary. Frank knows a puddle of water when he sees it, and as to Mrs. Bates's, he may get there from the Crown in a hop, step, and jump.
They were permitted to go alone, and with a cordial nod from one and a graceful bow from the other, the two gentlemen took leave. Emma remained very well pleased with this beginning of the acquaintance. The next morning brought Mr. Frank Churchill again. He came with Mrs. Weston, who had desired him to choose their walk. He had immediately fixed on Highbury. Highbury, with Mrs. Weston, stood for Hartfield, and she trusted to its bearing the same construction with him. They walked thither directly. Emma had hardly expected them. It was an agreeable surprise, therefore, to perceive them walking up to the house together, arm in arm. She was wanting to see him again, and especially to see him in company with Mrs. Weston, upon his behaviour to whom her opinion of him was to depend. On seeing them together, she became perfectly satisfied. Nothing could be more proper or pleasing than his whole manner to her, and his wish to consider her as a friend and secure her affection. And there was time enough for Emma to form a reasonable judgment, as their visit included all the rest of the morning. They walked first round the shrubberies of Hartfield, and afterwards Mr. Woodhouse joined them to walk into Highbury. Mr. Frank Churchill was delighted with everything and admired Hartfield sufficiently for Mr. Woodhouse's ear. Their first pause was at the Crown Inn, an inconsiderable house, but one with a little history, which Mr. Woodhouse wished to impart.
This may interest you, Mr. Churchill. Mark this large room, visibly added. It was built many years ago for a ballroom, and while the neighbourhood had been in a particularly populous dancing state, had been used as such.
Was it indeed? Have you ever danced here, Miss Woodhouse?
No. I'm afraid such brilliant days have long passed away. Its highest purpose now is to accommodate a whist club.
Oh, that is a great pity. It is long enough, broad enough, handsome enough. It would hold the very number for comfort. You ought to have bulls here at least every fortnight through the winter. Miss Woodhouse, why have you not revived the former good old days of the room? You who could do anything in Highbury.
He argued like a young man very much bent on dancing, and Emma was rather surprised to see the constitution of the Western prevail so decidedly against the habits of the Churchills. He seemed to have all the life and spirit, cheerful feelings and social inclinations of his father, and nothing of the pride or reserve of Enscombe. At last he was persuaded to move on from the Crown, and being now in front of Ford's shop, almost facing the house where the Bateses lodged, Emma recollected his intended visit the day before and asked him if he had paid it.
Yes, oh, yes, I was just going to mention it. A very successful visit. I saw all the three ladies and felt very much obliged to you for your preparatory hint. If the talking aunt had taken me quite by surprise, it must have been the death of me. 10 minutes would have been all that was necessary, but there was no getting away, no pause, and to my utter astonishment, I found that when I took my leave, I had been actually sitting with them very nearly 3/4 of an hour. The good lady had not given me the possibility of escape before.
And how did you think Miss Fairfax looking?
Not at all well, I'm afraid. I hesitate to say she appears ill, but Miss Fairfax is naturally so pale as almost always to give the appearance of ill health. A most deplorable want of complexion.
No, I cannot agree with you. There is a softness and delicacy in her skin which give peculiar elegance to the character of her face. Did you see her often at Weymouth? Were you often in the same society?
Ah, Ford. So this must be the very shop that everybody attends every day of their lives, as my father informs me. If it be not inconvenient to you, pray let us go in, that I may prove myself to belong to the place, to be a true citizen of Highbury. I must buy something at Ford's. I dare say they sell gloves. Let me see to the door.
Good morning, Mrs. Weston. Mr. Woodhouse, Miss Woodhouse, what might you like to see?
Gloves, if we may, Mrs. Ford, for Mr. Churchill.
Of course, madam.
Shall we begin with York Taff, Mrs. Weston?
Yes, indeed. It is always...
But I beg your pardon, Miss Woodhouse. You were saying something to me. Do not let me lose it.
I merely asked whether you had known much of Miss Fairfax and her party at Weymouth.
And now that I understand your question, I must pronounce it to be a very unfair one. It is always the lady's right to decide on the degree of acquaintance. Miss Fairfax must already have given her account. I shall not commit myself by claiming more than she may choose to allow.
Upon my word, you answer as discreetly as she could do herself. But her account of everything leaves so much to be guessed. She's so very reserved, so very unwilling to give the least information about anybody, that I really think you may say what you like of your acquaintance with her.
May I? Indeed. Then I will speak the truth, and nothing suits me so well. I met her frequently at Weymouth. I had known the Campbells a little in town, and at Weymouth we were very much in the same set. Colonel Campbell is a very agreeable man, and Mrs. Campbell a friendly, warm-hearted woman. I like them all.
You know Miss Fairfax's situation in life, I conclude, what she is destined to be.
Yes, at least I believe I do.
Mr. Churchill, you must choose for yourself, or you shall purchase gloves of our choosing rather than your own.
Mr. Woodhouse, I can think of nothing better than the combined taste of yourself and Mrs. Weston. Have you reached a consensus?
We think the York tan has the advantage. It is most fitting in town or country.
Then let me try them. Ah, perfect fit! The York tan it is!
Shall I wrap them, sir?
No, I shall take them in their box. Thank you, Mrs. Ford. Good day to you.
Good day, sir.
There. I am a true local.
They quitted the shop and walked towards Hartfield. Mrs. Weston and Mr. Woodhouse soon fell into conversation again, leaving Emma and Frank Churchill able to speak in confidence. There was a fleeting moment in which Emma considered whether this was by coincidence or design.
Tell me, Miss Woodhouse, the young lady we were speaking of, did you ever hear her play?
Ever hear her? You forget how much she belongs to Highbury. I've heard her every year of our lives since we both began. She plays charmingly.
Oh, you think so, do you? I wanted the opinion of someone who could really judge. She appeared to me to play well, that is, with considerable taste, but I know nothing of the matter myself. You, who have known Miss Fairfax from a child, must be a better judge of her abilities and, indeed, her character than I can be.
I have known her from a child, undoubtedly. We have been children and women together, and it is natural to suppose that we should be intimate, that we should have taken to each other whenever she visited her friends. But we never did. I hardly know how it has happened. A little, perhaps, from that wickedness on my side, which was prone to take disgust towards a girl so idolised and so cried up as she always was by her aunt and grandmother and all their set. And then her reserve. I never could attach myself to anyone so completely reserved.
It is a most repulsive quality, indeed. Oftentimes very convenient, no doubt, but never pleasing. There is safety in reserve, but no attraction. One cannot love a reserved person.
Not till the reserve ceases towards oneself, and then the attraction may be the greater.
He perfectly agreed with her, and after walking together so long and thinking so much alike, Emma felt herself so well acquainted with him that she could hardly believe it to be only their second meeting. He was not exactly what she had expected. Less of the man of the world in some of his notions, less of the spoiled child of fortune, therefore better than she had expected. And after several days of his paying such particular attentions to her, she believed he was already in love with her, or very near it, saved only by her own indifference, for still her resolution held of never marrying. Emma's very good opinion of Frank Churchill was a little shaken the following day, however, by hearing that he was gone off to London merely to have his hair cut. Mr. and Mrs. Weston reported the story during their morning visit to Hartfield. There was certainly no harm in his travelling 16 miles twice over on such an errand, but there was an air of foppery and nonsense in it which Emma could not approve. In general, he was judged throughout the parishes of Donwell and Highbury with great candour. Liberal allowances were made for the little excesses of such a handsome young man, one who smiled so often and bowed so well. But one spirit among them was not to be softened by bows or smiles. Mr. Knightley. Upon hearing of Mr. Frank Churchill's indulgence, he could only judge him to be just the trifling, silly fellow I took him for. The real proof of the man's character came from Mrs. Weston, who was very ready to say how much she saw to like in his disposition and manners. Mr. Weston, on his side, gave Emma to understand that Frank admired her extremely, thought her very beautiful and very charming, and with so much to be said for him altogether, she found she must not judge him harshly. This was all very promising. He was proving himself worthy of the distinguished honour which her imagination had given him, of being marked out for her by all their joint acquaintance. The conversation was altered by necessity when an invitation arrived for Emma and her father, one that had been looked for and fretted over in equal measure. An invitation to dinner from the Coles. They were a very good sort of people, but they were of low origin, in trade, and only moderately genteel. The last year or two, however, had brought them a considerable increase of means, and by this time were, in fortune and style of living, second only to the family at Hartfield. Their love of society and their new dining room prepared everybody for their keeping dinner company. The regular and best families Emma could hardly suppose they would presume to invite, neither Donwell, nor Hartfield, nor Randalls. Nothing should tempt her to go if they did. But she had made up her mind how to meet this presumption so many weeks before it appeared that when the insult came at last it found her very differently affected. Donwell and Randalls had received their invitation, and none had come for her father and herself. She felt that she should like to have had the power of refusal, and yet, as the idea of the party to be assembled there, consisting precisely of those whose society was dearest to her, occurred in conversation again and again, she did not know that she might not have been tempted to accept. She sought the Westons' advice on the matter.
I own that, considering everything, I am not absolutely without inclination for the party. The Coles express themselves so properly and explain the delay of the invitation. They write, "We would have solicited the honour earlier, but have been waiting the arrival of a folding screen from London, which we hope might keep Mr. Woodhouse from any draught of air, and therefore induce him the more readily to give us the honour of his company."
I do not think there can be any reason to refuse, Emma.
No, indeed. They are a very good sort of people, and we should not enjoy the evening half so much if you did not join us.
I am very persuadable. Papa, what think you?
I am not fond of dinner visiting. I never was. No more is Emma. Late hours do not agree with us. I am sorry Mr. and Mrs. Cole should have done it. I think it would be much better if they could come in one afternoon next summer to take their tea with us, and yet get home without being in the damp of the evening. The dews of a summer evening are what I would not expose anybody to. However, as they are so very desirous to have dear Emma dine with them, and as you will both be there, and Mr. Knightley too, to take care of her, I cannot wish to prevent it. Provided, of course, the weather be what it ought, neither damp, nor cold, nor windy.
Thank you, Papa. I feel quite sure it will be a fine evening, and I shall be perfectly safe among our friends.
With Tuesday came the agreeable prospect of an evening with those friends, and of seeing Mr. Frank Churchill again for a longer time than hitherto. It gave her the opportunity of judging his general manners, and by inference, the meaning of his manners towards herself, and how soon it might be necessary for her to throw coldness into her air. Her father's comfort for the evening was amply secured, with Mrs. Bates and Mrs. Goddard for company at Hartfield, and Emma was driven by James to the Coles. She was received with a cordial respect which could not but please, and given all the consequence she could wish for. When the Westons arrived, the kindest looks of love, the strongest of admiration, were for her from both husband and wife. Moments later, Frank Churchill approached her with a cheerful eagerness, which marked her as his peculiar object, and at dinner she found him seated by her, and, as she firmly believed, not without some dexterity on his side. The less worthy females were to come in the evening, including Miss Bates, Miss Fairfax, and Miss Smith, but already at dinner they were numerous. Mrs. Cole seemed to be relating something that was expected to be very interesting. Emma listened and found it well worth listening to.
I was calling on Miss Bates earlier, and as soon as I entered the room, I was struck by the sight of a pianoforte, a very elegant-looking instrument, not a grand, but a large-sized, square pianoforte. It arrived from Broadwood's the day before, I am told, to the great astonishment of both aunt and niece. It was so entirely unexpected that at first, by Miss Bates' account, Jane herself was quite at a loss, quite bewildered to think who could possibly have ordered it. But now they were both perfectly satisfied that it could be from only one quarter. Of course, it must be from Colonel Campbell. I declare, I do not know when I have heard anything that has given me more satisfaction. It always has quite hurt me that Jane Fairfax, who plays so delightfully, should not have an instrument. I was saying this to Mr. Cole but yesterday.
I quite agree.
Why do you smile?
Nay, why do you?
Me? I suppose I smile for pleasure at Colonel Campbell's being so rich and so liberal. It is a handsome present.
Very.
I rather wonder that it was never made before.
Perhaps Miss Fairfax has never been staying here so long before.
Why did he not give her the use of their own instrument? It must now be shut up in London, untouched by anybody.
That is a grand pianoforte, and he might think it too large for Mrs. Bates's house.
You may say what you choose, but your countenance testifies that your thoughts on this subject are very much like mine.
I do not know. I rather believe you are giving me more credit for acuteness than I deserve. I smile because you smile and shall probably suspect whatever I find you suspect. But at present, I do not see what there is to question. If Colonel Campbell is not the person, who can be?
What do you say to Mr. and Mrs. Dixon?
The Dixon? Very true, indeed. They must both know how acceptable an instrument it would be to Jane, and perhaps the mode of it, the mystery, the surprise, has the hint of a woman's scheme. It is Mr. and Mrs. Dixon, I dare say. I told you that your suspicions would guide mine.
I have entertained an idea which such a gift may give weight to. I do not mean to reflect upon the good intentions of either Mr. Dixon or Miss Fairfax.
And yet you have an idea of something.
I cannot help suspecting that after making his proposals to her dear friend Miss Campbell, Mr. Dixon had the misfortune to fall in love with Miss Fairfax, or that he became conscious of a little attachment on her side. One might guess 20 things without guessing exactly the right, but I'm sure there must be a particular cause for her choosing to come to Highbury instead of going with the Campbells to Ireland. Here, she must be leading a life of privation and penance. There, it would have been all enjoyment. As to the pretense of trying her native air, I look upon that as a mere excuse. In the summer, it might have passed. But what can anybody's native air do for them in the months of January, February, and March? Good fires and carriages would be much more to the purpose in most cases of delicate health, and I dare say in hers. I do not require you to adopt all my suspicions, though you make so noble a profession of doing it, but I honestly tell you what they are.
And, upon my word, they have an air of great probability.
And then, Mr. Dixon saved her life. Did you ever hear of that? A water party, and by some accident she was falling overboard. He caught her.
He did. I was there, one of the party.
Were you really? Well, but you observed nothing, of course, for my notion of some attachment between them seems to be a new idea to you. If I had been there, I think I should have made some discoveries.
I dare say you would. But I, simple I, saw nothing but the facts. Miss Fairfax was nearly dashed from the vessel, and Mr. Dixon caught her. It was the work of a moment, the consequent shock was much more durable. But there was too general a sensation for anything of peculiar anxiety to be observable in him, to my eye at least.
The arrival of this pianoforte is decisive with me. I wanted to know a little more, and this tells me quite enough. Depend upon it, we shall soon hear that it is a present from Mr. and Mrs. Dixon, though all arranged by him.
Your reasonings carry my judgment along with them entirely. I am quite of your mind.
There was no occasion to press the matter further. The conviction seemed real. He looked as if he felt it. Other subjects took their turn, and the rest of the dinner passed away. A few clever things were said, a few downright silly, but nothing worse than everyday remarks, dull repetitions, old news, and heavy jokes. The ladies then took their leave of the table and the gentlemen. They had not been long in the drawing room before the other ladies in their different divisions arrived. Emma watched the entree of her dear Harriet and heartily rejoiced in that light, cheerful disposition which allowed her to feel pleasure amid the pangs of disappointed affection. There she sat, smiling and looking pretty, and who would have guessed how many tears she had been lately shedding? They were soon joined by some of the gentlemen, led by Frank Churchill. In he walked, the first and the handsomest, and after paying his compliments en passant to Miss Bates and her niece, made his way directly to Miss Woodhouse, until he could find a seat by her would not sit at all. Emma divined what everybody present must be thinking. She was his object, and everybody must perceive it. When a seat became vacant beside her, he took it immediately and began to speak in earnest.
Miss Woodhouse, I have made a most wretched discovery. I have been here a week tomorrow, half my time. I never knew days fly so fast. A week tomorrow! And I have hardly begun to enjoy myself, but just got acquainted with Mrs. Weston and others. I hate the recollection.
Perhaps you may now begin to regret that you spent one whole day out of so few in having your hair cut.
No. That is no subject of regret at all. I have no pleasure in seeing my friends unless I can believe myself fit to be seen.
The rest of the gentlemen being now in the room, Emma found herself obliged to turn from him for a few minutes and listen to Mr. Cole. When Mr. Cole had moved away and her attention could be restored as before, she saw Frank Churchill looking intently across the room at Miss Fairfax, who was sitting exactly opposite.
What is the matter?
Oh, thank you for rousing me. I believe I've been very rude, but really, Miss Fairfax has done her hair in so odd a way that I cannot keep my eyes from her. I never saw anything so outré. Those curls. This must be a fancy of her own. I see nobody else looking like her. I must go and ask her whether it is an Irish fashion. Shall I? Yes, I will. I declare I will, and you shall see how she takes it, whether she colours.
He was gone immediately, and Emma soon saw him standing before Miss Fairfax and talking to her, but she could not perceive its effect on the young lady. Frank had improvidently placed himself exactly between them, exactly in front of Miss Fairfax, so that Emma could absolutely distinguish nothing. It was a most provoking interlude in what was otherwise proving a delightful evening. Emma was gratified to see that the Coles were proving themselves excellent hosts to their numerous party. All was comfortable, warm, and nothing was wanting, except in some refinement of taste in the manner of decoration in the drawing room. It was a minor lapse, however, and one that Emma released from her thoughts almost as soon as it had occurred to her. In the momentary absence of Frank Churchill from the seat next to her, Mrs. Weston took it and spoke in an excited, confidential tone to her friend.
This is the luxury of a large party. One can get near everybody and say everything. My dear Emma, I am longing to talk to you. I have been making discoveries and forming plans just like yourself, and I must tell them while the idea is fresh. Do you know how Miss Bates and her niece came here?
They walked, to be sure. How else could they come?
Very true. Well, a little while ago it occurred to me how very sad it would be to have Jane Fairfax walking home again late at night, and cold as the nights are now, poor girl. I could not bear the idea of it. So I spoke to Mr. Weston about the carriage. You may guess how readily he supported the idea. I made my way directly to Miss Bates to assure her that the carriage would be at her service before it took us home. Good soul. She was as grateful as possible, you may be sure. And yet, there was no occasion to trouble us, she said, for Mr. Knightley's carriage had brought them and was to take them home again. I was quite surprised. Very glad, I am sure, but really quite surprised. Such a very kind and thoughtful attention. The sort of thing that so few men would think of. And in short, from knowing his usual ways, I am very much inclined to think that it was for their accommodation the carriage was used at all.
Very likely indeed, for he seldom uses his carriage to get about himself, and I know no man more likely than Mr. Knightley to arrange something so good-natured, so benevolent. He is not a gallant man, but he is a very humane one.
Well, you give him credit for more simple, disinterested benevolence in this instance than I do. For while Miss Bates was speaking, a suspicion darted into my head, and I have never been able to get it out again. The more I think of it, the more probable it appears. In short, I have made a match between Mr. Knightley and Jane Fairfax. What do you say to it?
Mr. Knightley and Jane Fairfax? Dear Mrs. Weston, how could you think of such a thing? Mr. Knightley must not marry. You would not have little Henry cut out from Donwell. Oh, no, no, his brother must have Donwell. I cannot at all consent to Mr. Knightley's marrying, and I am sure it is not at all likely. I'm amazed that you should think of such a thing.
My dear Emma, I have told you what led me to think of it. I do not want the match, but if Mr. Knightley really wished to marry, you would not have him refrain on Henry's account, a boy of 6 years old who knows nothing of the matter?
Yes, I would. I cannot bear to have Henry supplanted. Mr. Knightley marry? No, I have never had such an idea, and I cannot adopt it now. And Jane Fairfax, too, of all women.
Nay, she has always been a favourite with him, as you very well know.
But the imprudence of such a match.
I am not speaking of its prudence, merely its probability.
I see no probability in it, unless you have any better foundation than what you mention. His good nature, his humanity, as I tell you, would be quite enough to account for the horses. My dear Mrs. Weston, do not take to matchmaking. You do it very ill. Jane Fairfax, mistress of the Abbey. Oh, no, no, every feeling revolts. For his own sake, I would not have him do so mad a thing.
Imprudent, if you please, but not mad. Excepting inequality of fortune and perhaps a little disparity of age, I can see nothing unsuitable.
But Mr. Knightley does not want to marry. I'm sure he has not the least idea of it. Do not put it into his head. Why should he marry? He is as happy as possible by himself, with his farm and his sheep and his library and all the parish to manage, and he is extremely fond of his brother's children. He has no occasion to marry, either to fill up his time or his heart.
My dear Emma, as long as he thinks so, it is so. But if he really loves Jane Fairfax...
Nonsense. He does not care about Jane Fairfax. In the way of love, I am sure he does not. It would be a very shameful and degrading connection. How would he bear to have Miss Bates belonging to him? To have her haunting the Abbey and thanking him all day long for his great kindness in marrying Jane? So very kind and obliging, but he always had been such a very kind neighbour.
For shame, Emma. Do not mimic her. You divert me against my conscience. But the question is not whether it would be a bad connection for him, but whether he wishes it. And I think he does. I have heard him speak, and so must you, so very highly of Jane Fairfax. Such an admirer of her performance on the pianoforte, and of her voice. I have heard him say that he could listen to her forever. Oh, and I had almost forgotten one idea that occurred to me. This pianoforte that has been sent here by somebody, We have all been so well satisfied to consider it a present from the Campbells. But may it not be from Mr. Knightley? I cannot help suspecting him. I think he is just the person to do it, even without being in love.
Then it can be no argument to prove that he is in love. But I do not think it is at all likely that he sent it. Mr. Knightley does nothing mysteriously.
Still, I have a very strong notion that it comes from him. I am sure he was particularly silent when Mrs. Cole told us of it at dinner.
You take up an idea, Mrs. Weston, and run away with it, as you have many a time reproached me with doing. I see no sign of attachment. I believe nothing of the pianoforte, and proof only shall convince me that Mr. Knightley has any thought of marrying Jane Fairfax.
They combated the point some time longer in the same way, Emma rather gaining ground over the mind of her friend, for Mrs. Weston was the most used of the two to yield, till a little bustle in the room showed them that tea was over and the instrument in preparation. Mrs. Cole entreated Miss Woodhouse to try it first, and as in every respect it suited Emma best to lead, she gave a very proper compliance. She played and sang tolerably well, but knew the limitations of her own powers too well to attempt more than she could perform with credit. The accompaniment to her second song took her agreeably by surprise. It was Frank Churchill. He was accused of having a delightful voice and a perfect knowledge of music, which was properly denied. They sang together once more, and Emma would then resign her place to Miss Fairfax, whose performance, both vocal and instrumental, was infinitely superior to her own. Frank Churchill sang again to accompany Jane. They had sung together once or twice, it appeared, at Weymouth. But the sight of Mr. Knightley, among the most attentive, soon drew away half Emma's mind, and she fell into a train of thinking on the subject of Mrs. Weston's suspicions. Presently, Mr. Knightley looked back and came and sat down by her. They talked at first.